The subject of the talk is loving through difficulty. And many of you have reported in the meetings and in the dialogue and the groups also that difficult experiences arise in this retreat, and it's all the stuff that comes up, and you're almost shocked. We're talking about love, and we're talking about softness, and talking about kindness, and talking about calmness, and we're sitting quietly, like kind of just like cats in an armchair, and all this stuff is coming up. And I think we really need to be reminded that actually we arrive in this moment with all the good things and the joys of life, but a lot of wounds. We are quite wounded, and this is in the nature of the struggle to survive as human beings in this world. And so we do arrive in the present moment quite scarred, like kind of been through battles and been through struggles, like an old soldiers in a way, through all these the conditioning of life. And so it's worth bringing up this word dukkha. Dukkha meaning dissatisfaction, unsatisfactoriness, suffering, which I don't like that word too much. But it is part of the experience of all living creatures, whether it's an ant or a human being. Suffering is part of our experience as living beings, trying to stay alive, trying to exist, when in a way all the world is trying to take us to pieces again. And this pain of life, these wounds can be quite strong and physical, like loss or disease or death, or someone that, or loss of someone close to us. But they can also be quite subtle, such as the pain of conditioning, of being shaped by life. Within, that means all the tavniot, all the patterns and the buttons that get pressed by other people, and the reactivity that we have, and the habits that we've grown with that we don't like, and the addictions that we have to things. So they're more subtle, but they're part of the story, and they're part of our wounds. So somewhere or other, the scars of our life are written in to our conscious and our unconscious being. They are part of the writing in us. And they're also written into the heart. And when we come to a retreat and we sit quietly, we can get surprised. Where did that come from? I thought it was a lovely, quiet retreat at Ain Dor. Why did that stuff come out? Why am I bothered by all these disturbing thoughts? Why is my heart, which is meant to love, bringing up anger right now, and irritation, and negativity, and disappointment, and feeling unpleasant? So we can get surprised. And one of the things we should understand is that the practice itself, especially after 2 or 3 days, is like a still pool of water. And because the mind has more space and more concentration, then stuff comes out, comes up. It floats up from the unconscious, like in still water. Stuff from underneath floats up, or we can see more deeply and clearly what's underneath. And often it's a lot of mud with a few creatures crawling about. So on the side of Vipassana, what we've been practicing so far in the practice of awareness, we learn that this isn't the nature of our experience, and that when we keep quiet, aware, and give space to our inner life, so things come up, and we learn to allow them to be what they are. We learn to give them their attention that they ask for, even if they're not pleasant. We learn not to run away. We learn a little bit to step out, to disidentify, to step back from these experiences and be able to watch them as phenomena that come and go. And that process of Vipassana is the process of, you say, purification or cleaning the mud at the bottom of the pool, or dealing with, which is not such a good word, but we can, you know what I mean, is kind of being a little bit freer, even though all these things are coming up, our patterns, our angers, our history, our biography, our scars and wounds of the battle of life. They'll come up, and we learn through awareness to allow them, give them space, and let them go. Give them space, pay attention to them, hold them in attention, and let them go. Because they go anyway, they pass through. Metta, what we're learning here, the power of the heart, works in a slightly different way from Vipassana. And metta is a little more active. And I mentioned this yesterday, but I want to bring it up again because it's important. Metta would say to us, yes, we have these voices, these scars of life written into the system and written into the heart, but instead of attacking them with a sword of wisdom, or cutting them with a sword of wisdom, we give them a kiss. Our stuff that's coming up, we just give them a kiss. Now, the weapons with which we deal with our pains are different. I'm reminded of the mythology which describes this. There's a huge amount of mythology which describes this, and you all know from folk stories of how the hero, which is us, you and me, here, we are the heroes, and we are traveling on this journey, and we meet the ugly frog by the pool, and we know that we have to kiss this frog, and when we kiss this frog, he will become a prince or a princess. And this is folk tales. Or we meet the ugly woman and we know we have to give her a kiss or a hug, and she turns into a princess. And all the demons within us, all the shedim, the demons of our pains and our patterns and our difficulties and our threats and our fears, Metta invites us to give them a kiss, to hug our demons. Vipassana invites us to look at them clearly and look at them in the eyes and see what they're made of and know that they come and go anyway. But metta asks us to give our demons love. And when we give a demon love, you know what happens to him or her? Just collapses. There's a famous story about a demon that came into a palace when the king was away. And the demon sat on the king's throne, the shed. Sat on the throne, the kiseh kavod of the king. And all the court said, "What are you doing here, you ugly beast, you horrible creature, you smelly thing, get off." And he loved that. The more they shouted, the bigger he got. And he got bigger and bigger, and they kept shouting at him, "Go away, you horrible thing, go away, go away." And he got bigger and bigger and bigger. And they didn't know what to do, and he began to fill the whole palace. So they called the king to come back. And the king came back, and he walked into the palace. And there was the demon, enormous, big, filling the whole room. And he said to the demon, "Hi, nice to see you there. Are you comfortable?" And the demon a little bit collapsed, a little bit. "Welcome. Can I get you a cup of tea?" "You look so good there. I'm happy for you to be a guest. Come and join our court." So gradually through kindness, the demon just went smaller and smaller and then just crept away in the end. There's nothing for him there to do. So it's a little bit like that with our demons. If we, on the one hand, see them clearly, we can see that all our demons are a bit like children dressed up in clothes on Purim. If we look inside them, there's a little kid there, really sweet, but we have to look clearly and see the demons are just dressed up. And that's our fears and our issues. But the love side, the metta, is another way. And really we need to deal with our demons with both together. To give them a kiss, but see them absolutely clearly as they are. And the two ways together, one adds to the other. They add to each other. They help each other in the process of purification, tihur, of all the scars of living. I was really impressed with one time I went to give a talk at a unit in Oxford University with Professor Mark Williams, and he developed a technique called MBCT, Mindfulness-Based Cognitive Therapy. And this is where mindfulness, which is what basically we're practicing here, if mindfulness has been developed by academics into a very, very precise protocol for dealing especially with depression. And often with young people who not treated with other means. MBCT has turned out to be really, really successful and really used widespread, especially with young people. And I talked to him about MBCT, and he was saying they were trying to understand why it works, mindfulness, as a therapy for depression. And they kind of tried to understand, so they, you know, in a scientific way, they tried to take it to pieces. What bits work? This is science, okay? Just, we have to forgive them with compassion. And he said they did a study to teach mindfulness in a very neutral way, without any metta, without any kindness or compassion, and it didn't work. And it only worked as a therapeutic tool if compassion and heart and kindness and metta, and exactly what we're practicing here, it only worked if that was part of it. It was essential that the heart and the mind were together in a very controlled protocol that seemed very scientific and so on, but using attention, the heart and the mind have to go together all the time. When the phrases as a training in heartfulness, the phrases that you've been hearing today and I hope practicing today, when the phrases meet our difficult biography, they meet the pains and the wounds of life. It's not always, they're not always going to produce a sweet result. Sometimes when the phrases touch us, what happens is the heart is triggered and it expresses the strongest thing that it needs to express at this minute. So it's good to realize that just because we use phrases or we practice metta, we are not controlling the outcome. So we try and kiss the demon. The demon can give us a maka. We use the phrases to open the heart, but what the heart might say is, I'm in pain. And that's okay. And it can really happen that metta triggers anger, resistance, loneliness, feelings of helplessness or sadness or irritation. And we get surprised. Why? I'm trying to practice kindness. And these beautiful phrases, may I be happy and peaceful, and I just feel the opposite. I feel unhappy and unpeaceful. Okay, so I say a few more phrases, may I be happy and peaceful, even more unhappy and even more unpeaceful. So I'm not doing the practice right. You are doing the practice right. It's that the heart is wounded and it's telling us this. And that's fine. It needs to express itself. The heart needs to be listened to. One of the images that one of my teachers used for this is that metta is like drops of cool water that drop onto a hot fire, a hot plate. And when the drop of cool water hits the hot plate, what happens? Psst, there is a reaction. Psst, steam. Psst. But actually, it does work to cool the hot plate, but it takes time. So on the way, we may feel that the heart is telling us it's pain. It's on the way. And slowly, slowly, the sweetness of the triggers in words or in metta practice, however we practice it, these triggers, they work slowly, slowly to sweeten, to purify the emotional life. The heart starts off with a really cacophonia of feelings. And the metta practice turns it into music. The metta practice turns this into music. and giving. Music is a music of kindness, of harmony. I remember a story, I've never forgotten this, and any of you that been sitting on metta retreats with me before, or maybe some other retreats, would have heard this story before, because it's to me such a amazing story. There was a woman in a metta retreat some years ago at Kibbutz Inbar with Marcia Rose teaching, and she had cancer, and she had a quite advanced cancer. In fact, she was sitting with oxygen in a carriage with her. Everywhere she goes, she had to have a cylinder of oxygen with her. And one day in the retreat, I sat with her and said, how are things? And she was saying, terrible disaster. It's awful. I'm just sitting there in the room feeling so angry, angry with my body, angry with the doctors, angry with my parents, angry with life. Why does life do that to me? I'm a young woman, I have children. Why does life do that to me? As she was saying it, I watched her eyes, and I saw that there was, behind what she was saying, there was a little twinkle in her eyes, a little shine in her eyes. And then she said, but I must tell you that I went out onto the hilltop and I had one moment of absolute unconditional love, and that moment was worth the whole thing. And there were tears in her eyes of joy, and mine as well. So yes, there can be difficulty that comes up, there can be anger, there can be reactions, there can be that the heart will tell its story. We let it. The phrases are triggers. They stimulate the heart. We don't need to get too much into the meaning. The meaning of the phrases, when we think about them, becomes thought. What we need to do with the phrases, or with the practice itself, is just feel the energy of the phrases that are words that create a vibration, a reaction, a response in the heart. We don't need to think too much about the exact meaning of them. We can, it's okay. For example, sometimes I like to think, if you say, may I be happy and peaceful, it sort of tells you that I'm not happy and peaceful and I want to be. May I be means I wasn't and I want to be. But if we just see, may I be happy and peaceful, as a kind of a blessing, bracha, then it takes away a sense of, we have to think about, well, am I peaceful and happy and peaceful? Am I not peaceful? Just a blessing. Bracha, happy and peaceful. I remember that when I first did this practice with Sharon Salzberg in Switzerland, for, it was quite a long retreat, it was several weeks, and I chose, after the first period of time, to shorten the phrases. That was my own choice, into just two words, be happy. And so at the beginning I said the phrases completely and they were with me, and then they just got shorter and shorter. I could drop this word and drop another word and drop another word and drop another word, and it got shorter and shorter until it was just be happy. But that was my personal choice. Doesn't mean you should do that. It was only something, I'm just telling it to you from my practice many years ago. And I felt be happy was fine, was just right for me. And I would walk every day in the woods. And just using this movement of the heart and the words in every change that came through the senses. A leaf falling from a tree, be happy. A cloud passing, be happy. My feet walking, be happy. A dog passing by, be happy. The leaves in the trees, be happy. The body, be happy. The breath, be happy. Feelings, be happy. So it's kind of triggering all the time the heart in a very simple way, but applying it to everything. And that for me was the key to the practice. It's just filling the heart with this blessing, be happy. I remember seeing, it was a season where there were lots of slugs. I don't know, it's an English word for, what are they called in Hebrew? They're like snails without a shell. What are they called? Chasufiot. Chasufiot. Well, they were red, very strong color in the forest, and many of them. And this was the mating season. So I kept seeing two of them like this together, wrapped in the rear kind of two together, and they looked so happy. They were just mating each other, wrapped together in a kind of package of slime. Rear. So be happy, be happy, be happy.
They were
absolutely happy. Didn't need my blessing, but I needed my blessing. It was for me. They were all right anyway. One thing that I want to add to at this time, to the practice in a slightly practical way, that when we say the phrases, we need to give them a little space. And it's something that we're going to remind maybe again tomorrow. Give them a little space. So one image that I like that I heard is like the phrase, because it's strong and clear as a kind of a reminder of the heart or a stimulation of the heart. Strong and clear, words are strong and clear. They stimulate the heart, but then we need to kind of connect a little bit with the feelings that are there. And to listen to the heart, we give a little space. So I would suggest have sometimes a small moment of really feeling what the heart is saying. And a bit like a phrase is a bit like throwing a stone in a pond and then watching the ripples. Zorkim even bebrecha veroim et ha'advot. Ha'advot are the feelings of the heart, the response of the heart to the phrases. So give it a little space, the phrases, be listening to what the heart is saying in response, whether the advot, the ripples, whatever the heart is saying, it's still the music and the language that we need to listen to and connect with. The heart is telling us things. There's something very, very simple in metta. And Simi said it this morning, and like all teaching in the Dharma, it's a they're big, and we can't say it all, and we can't explain everything. But Simi this morning was talking about two fundamental movements of metta and making them very, very open and simple, really. The one movement is metta as friendliness. Because we've been using, and I've been using a lot, the word love. And Simi has said it already. The word love is kind of a heavy word. It's also a beautiful word, so sometimes can't find a better word. But it's heavy. It's kind of like, whoa, I have to love. Love is just too much and too big and too... But friendliness, this is easier to understand, easier to experience. And metta means that. It means friendliness to everything. To be a friend of ourselves, to be a friend of others, to feel that sense of, in the base, it's to be for and not against. In a very, the simplest movement of metta is about being for and not being against. Ba'ad, below neged. Being for the pain we experience. How do we heal ourselves? Basic healing that we heal ourselves is the body being for. And if we want to heal ourselves from a disease, from sickness, from issues, we are for them, we're not against them. If we're against disease, we lose the power of life to heal ourselves. Being for is healing. And in our relationship to life, being for the life around us and not against it. Life is not against us. Life is not for us either. Life is just life. But we can be for life. Choose life, says in the Torah. Bechata chayim. That's metta. Bechata chayim. Choose life, before life, before, and this is it's really kind of a such a nice, beautiful heart-opening understanding. It's what allows me to keep teaching, for example, to be in this role of teaching. It gives energy. 20 years I've been teaching. Where's the energy coming from? Don't have to do it. Why should I do it? It's okay to sit at home under a tree, play with my grandchildren. Why do I need to do it? It's the friendliness, the love, that it gives energy and flow. And it's just a beautiful thing to do. So the for gives energy to be for life. I remember one of the beautiful expressions of this is the many years I started with others an organization called Shvila Zahav, and we did many peace walks throughout Israel and some in Palestine, and we would walk. This was an organization that was based on the Dharma, based exactly on the practice that we're doing here, but applying it in life to try and make peace between people in conflict. It wasn't just between Jews and Arabs or Israelis and Palestinians. Sometimes it was Israelis and Israelis. We went to Gaza, for example, at the time of the Hitnatkut, to try and help peace to the Israelis and Israelis to be peaceful with each other. And anyway, we did many peace walks throughout Israel. And they were quiet and slow, just as we're walking outside here. And one of the tools that we use was metta. And we expressed this as friendliness. So we were walking through Jerusalem, we did many walks, or Tel Aviv, or the countryside, and all the time, someone we met on the side, give metta, friendliness, smile. Someone shouts at us, go home, you left wing, smile, friendliness. A dog passes by, smile, be friendly. A policeman comes to help. The policemen were so happy with us. It's unbelievable. We never had a problem with the police. They loved us. They would come and walk with us because the friendliness was really touching them. We were joking with them. We were not against them. We let them help us. We helped them. The army in the Machsomim, we walked along the Machsomim. We had one walk, I remember, from Barta, Mizrach, east of Barta, with around 300 Palestinians and maybe 100 Israelis and people from Chutz La'aretz. And we were training everybody at the first. We trained in friendliness. So when we came to the Mahsom, there were the soldiers, and they saw and felt our friendliness. And we're talking to them, and then we made circles, and we also danced outside the Mahsom. All the time, mostly Israel, Jews and Arabs together on these peace walks. And the friendliness was just so strong. We felt it ourselves. And even if we're walking through the countryside, just talking, being friendly to cows and trees, then we benefit and the cows benefit, not just the people. So friendliness is a way of being, really solves so many problems and can help us so much to bring joy, and it's so simple. And sometimes there isn't anything else that works. If we go into a place of real pain where no words can work anymore, we want to visit someone that's dying, for example, and what do we say? There isn't a word anymore, there's nothing to be said. And so we feel, well, what do we do? How can we help? There is a place to help. Our friendliness, our compassion, our heart is the kazeh breirat mechdal, as Simi said, the ground where nothing else works, go there. And even when things do work, also go there. Friendliness. And because of the friendliness, when we're practicing here, I suggest practice quite lightly. Be friendly to yourself with the phrases as you walk, as we eat. So it helps us to be a little lighter with the practice. Don't try and force metta. We have a tendency, okay, I'm going to real practice metta now. I'm going to really do it. I'm going to say the phrases for a whole hour nonstop, and I'm going to not miss one phrase, and I'm going to... It's not very friendly. So be friendly with ourselves as we practice friendliness. Okay? Softness. Another quality which is really important, and I want to add or expand again on Simi's word that she used. She used kirva, closeness. This is an extremely deep and profound understanding, in especially in the Buddhist world. And actually in all deep spiritual understanding is based on this. Kirva, if we take it more deeply, closeness is actually oneness. We are close because we are made of the same stuff. We are close to others because, like others, we share the same being. Everyone, all beings want to be happy. All beings don't want to die. All beings are struggling with their life. All beings share happiness and joy. All beings are fed mother's milk. All beings go back to the earth in the end. We are all the same in a certain deep way. This is the basis of metta, actually, and compassion. Our similarity, that we're made of the same stuff. And there's many ways to express this. The word of Thich Nhat Hanh, interbeing. Interbeing is that we're all with each other in a very similar way. The similarity between us and the other is what allows us to be close and friendly, and allows our heart to open to others because they're like us. The separation between us and others is artificial. It's based on our fear. So we might have the closeness experience within the family or within close friends, and then as the circle gets bigger, we're no longer close. But actually, if we remember how much we are similar to each other, how much we really want the same things and we think the same things and we share the same language or we share the same eye contact, and then we begin to, it's easy for us to love. We often feel, yeah, okay, well, I can, metta is easy, and love or closeness works, but not them. Or in my relationship inside my family or inside a place where I work, makom avoda, how can I love them when they do that? Or when they say that? Or when they believe that, which is totally wrong and harmful and awful? And why don't they believe what I believe? And why don't they do what I want them to do? So it is a real question. How can I love? How can I be close to others when they are like that? But if we practice metta, and as we practice metta during this retreat, we will be learning to expand our boundary of love, of friendliness. And someone can shout at us, we will still be friendly. And they don't shout at us, we will still be friendly. And what helps us is empathy. When the person, empathy is the basis of love and compassion. When the person that we don't like, if we have empathy with them, we see what's behind the eyes, we are already with them. Even if they say something that is annoying or difficult, or they think something, or they behave badly, or they behave against us, we look behind the eyes, it's empathy, the power of being with. And this is part of metta, this is part of development of metta. At the same time, the empathy is a result of vipassana. Our empathy grows by seeing. When we see behind the eyes of someone, we are using our consciousness to see more, and we're using our heart to feel them, and the two together work. It also applies to ourselves. When someone is against us, and we say, well, I don't love them, or I don't this person know, or this, my boss at work, how can I possibly, you know, it's impossible. Or the, person, policeman that arrested me the other day. How can I? But Vipassana will tell us also about ourselves. So if we think, I can't love them, there's also I in that Bhumishpat. I cannot love. So who is the I that cannot love them? We put the I, the me, in the picture. And that's Vipassana. That part of that is knowing, taking ourselves more lightly, we can allow much more of others. If we ourselves are light and free, then people can't hurt us. And it goes together, the awareness, the lightness, the sense of freedom that we have here goes together with kindness and the heartfulness with ourselves and with others. They always go together, the heart and the wisdom. And this leads me to finish with a few comments about spiritual life. Because in the end, this is what the Dharma is about. It's not just a teaching to make us feel a bit better in life. It's a teaching that goes all the way. And when I mean goes all the way, I mean a teaching that will open the door to spiritual life. And it's sort of, for me, the main thing. And so love or friendliness or connection or kirva, closeness, is all about being connected and being one with existence. In the end, ultimately, it's the way we join existence. And this is fundamentally a spiritual journey. It's about us and God. And I just, before I came to the retreat, I just suddenly realized that one of the most important instructions that every Jew will say, every Orthodox Jew will say five times a day, more or less, is Va'ahavta. Because in the Shema, in the prayer of the Shema, what's the instruction? The instruction is Va'ahavta. Adonai Elokecha, b'kol levavcha, b'kol nafshecha, b'kol moldecha, b'kol levavcha, kol ha-lev, b'kol ha-nefesh, nafshecha, the awareness, b'kol moldecha is the totality, mo'od ha-kol, everything, with all that you have. And my reading of the God world, it's the world of oneness. And it says in the Shema, by the way, Echad. And Echad is oneness. So how do you love oneness? With all your heart. Oneness. The divine, the totality. So it's inviting us, the spiritual life is inviting us to open the heart and be with the whole thing, with heart and mind, with wisdom and compassion, both together, opening doors more and more and more until we are at one with it all. There's a nice quote from Nisargadatta Maharaj. He says, wisdom tells me I am nothing. Love tells me I am everything. And between the two, my life flows. And so with that, I want to finish, but maybe to give a language that's a bit simpler than the spiritual language, because it maybe sounds a bit big and ultimate. But I think we can all understand and all feel, and we all have a hunger that we want to be a participating in life, a participant in the dance of life, and not a victim of life. And there is our choice, to be a victim of life or to be a participator of life. And that needs our friendliness to everything that arises. Thank you. So we'll take a few moments to sit quietly.